ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, writer Adam Kautzer joins me to talk about director Preston Sturges and his 1944 screwball comedy, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek.
I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realism, the problems that confront the average man.
But with a little six.
A little, but I don't want to stress it. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity.
But with a little six.
With a little sex in it.
Before we get to The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, we have to talk about its director, Preston Sturges, specifically. Sturges was born into a world of wealthy bohemianism. His mother, Mary Estelle Dempsey, left Sturges' father to become a singer in Paris. She'd soon marry wealthy stockbroker Solomon Sturges, who would adopt Preston, though that never dampened Mary's travels. She would take Preston back to Paris frequently, and he would consider it his second home. Later in his life, he'd work with her best friend, Isadora Duncan. So, Preston Sturges was kind of a wild card even before he got into directing.
Here's the gorgeous, tantalizing Lady Eve. Now, watch her go into action. She has her eye on this handsome, wealthy, but terribly naive and inexperienced young man who hasn't seen a white woman for a year. Now, every woman has her eyes on him. Big women, the female wrestler type. Little women, but with big claws. And that smoldering, simmering, exotic type. But only Lady Eve knows how to get him.
Sturges started out as a Broadway producer, but a string of flops left him as a writer for hire in Hollywood. His first original screenplay, The Power and the Glory, was produced by Fox in 1933. He was making quite a bit of money as a screenwriter, but oftentimes didn't receive credit for any of his contributions. Unhappy with how directors were handling his scripts, he decided to offer Paramount his screenplay for The Great McGinty with one caveat, that he would be the one to direct it. Sturges would soon become the first screenwriter to transition to directing his own projects, paving the way for the likes of later directors including Billy Wilder and John Huston. Sturges' gamble paid off, though, and The Great McGinty garnered him his only Academy Award for Best Screenplay.
What is this miracle of Morgan's Creek? We can't tell you now, but here's how it started. When Eddie Bracken, the nicest boy in town, brought home Betty Hutton, the peppiest girl in town, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And with a fire-eating father like Bill Demarest and a smarty kid sister like Diana Lynn, what happens to Eddie shouldn't happen.
Flat tire.
We fell asleep in the movie.
That's all I wanted to know.
In 1942, Sturges wanted to do his part for the war effort. His 1941 film Sullivan's Travels discussed the need for humor during times of struggle, and that probably explains why The Miracle of Morgan's Creek is by far his zaniest film. The story of a young woman who wakes up married and pregnant but without a man to speak of was Sturges' attempt to help young girls figure out that patriotism shouldn't be misconstrued for promiscuity. I'm hoping that there was a fair bit of sarcasm in his words there. Though shot throughout 1942 and 1943, the need for product left home studio Paramount trying to fill its pipeline, so Miracle of Morgan's Creek was held over until 1944. This actually worked in Sturges' favor because it allowed him and the studio time to argue with the Hayes office, who, in a 7-page letter, objected to various things in the story, including the heroine's pregnancy, fearing connections to the Virgin Mary of all things, her public drunkenness, and how troops would be depicted. With the Hayes office objecting to about 90% of the film, that left Sturges with just 10 approved pages of script. The film eventually was made and premiered in 1944 to huge crowds. Many theaters were standing room only because of its popularity. Critics were surprised that the Hayes office was so liberal in letting a film about unwed pregnancy slip by them, although, again, I don't understand how they let half the movie slip by them considering its character's name. The film was nominated for Best Screenplay that year, but so was Sturges' other film, Hail the Conquering Hero, and it's feared that the two split the vote, so Sturges ended up going home empty-handed.
Unfaithfully Yours is six kinds of picture all rolled into one. It is a picture of great music. A picture of sheer terror.
Oh! A director with more successes than failures in his career, Sturges only directed 14 times in total. He was incredibly temperamental, with a quest for perfectionism that often got him in trouble with the studio after bringing in movies over budget and over time. Though he was the third highest paid man in America from all his movie work, he was chronically short of money due to all his business ventures. He teamed up with Howard Hughes in 1944 to work as an independent director, taking a cue from the likes of Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford when they formed United Artists. But Hughes' eccentricities left Sturges in a quandary, with many projects never coming to fruition. He started putting out flops. He continued writing, but oftentimes the projects just never happened, often due to lack of funds. He released his final directorial effort, The French, They Are a Funny Race, in 1955, but it was another disaster. Married four times and boasting three sons, Sturges died of a heart attack at the famed Algonquin Hotel in 1959. Ironically, he was working on his autobiography, which would be released in 1990. A sad life to a director who made us laugh and think. After the break, guest Adam Kautzer and I take a look at the miracle of Morgan's Creek.
Once upon a night, two wisps of smoke were out on a lark. A witch and her father.
Goodbye, father.
Goodbye, Jennifer. Be a bad girl.
Her first night was a calamity, but she was rescued by a very handsome man.
Oh, I'm cold.
Cold in this furnace?
But I have no clothes.
Listeners, our main discussion this week sees us going all the way to 1944 and hanging out at Morgan's Creek, talking about Preston Sturges, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, and I am here with my very special guest and awesome podcast friend, Adam Kautzer. Adam, how are you?
I am perfect. It's a little hot. It's 108 where I live, but I'm doing perfect today.
You and I are actually at opposite ends of the same state.
Yes. You're in beautiful, I'm hoping it's nice and cool, Northern California. Oh, okay.
And I don't think it's as hot as Los Angeles, but we haven't hit fall yet. We're talking about a place where we're not really sure where the weather is like there, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, directed and written by the great Preston Sturges from 1944, stars Eddie Bracken and Betty Hutton, as well as Diana Lynn, William Demarest, a bunch of other fantastic character actors. This is, in a nutshell, the story of a woman who goes out to a party and proceeds to wake up the next morning married and pregnant with no concept of who the man is that she has been with. We're going to get into questions of how this ages in the land of consent in 2017, but that's the plot. The whole 90 minutes, 98 minutes or so is her attempt to legitimize both her pregnancy and her marriage. That's the great thing I find about Preston Sturges' films, is that his movies have these very simplistic, usually romantic plots, and they really dive into deeper subtext, like legitimacy or dealing with poverty or crime or stuff like that, corruption. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about all of that in a second. You suggested this, which I was very happy. This is usually not the Preston Sturges movie I think people would commonly bring up.
Yes.
So what is your background with this film, and why are we talking about it today?
Something that I think that a lot of people don't know about me, and I keep it a little, it's not a secret. It's just one of those things where when we talk preferences, Sturges is probably my favorite filmmaker of that era. Shockingly, I know that sounds weird, but I would put him above Billy Wilder. Greatness to output ratio, he's got Wilder beat. Limited amount of films, but all of them, in my estimation, even this one, part of the reason why I picked it was because of the fact that it's imperfect, but it's perfect in its imperfections. And it's a lot more interesting than talking about my favorite Sturges, which is Unfaithfully Yours. Because Unfaithfully Yours, it's so perfect in the way that it works as a film. I find perfect films are really boring to talk about, but imperfect films, films that say somebody is doing for alternate reasons, say that have troubling thematics in today's society, make for a much livelier conversation. And that's why I picked this one, because it hardly ever gets talked about, even though it's one of those films that you look at, you watch, and you go, how did he get away with this?
There are a lot of questions in terms of how Preston Sturges was able to finagle a story that just discussing the plot and the characters We talk a lot about the Hays Code and how things were changed because getting Clark Gable allowed to say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, in Gone with the Wind was something the studio had to finagle with the Hays office just to say damn. And this movie has a character whose last name is Cockenlocker, which the first time I heard that, I literally looked up from what I was doing and I said, oh, this movie's going to be amazing. And really, Preston Sturges, I think what he does so well, the Preston Sturges movie that I always love, and of course, everybody's going to say, of course, is Sullivan's Travels.
Yes.
Because it's got Veronica Lake in it. And I think Sullivan's Travels is such a great movie that has a deeper meaning and at the same time plays very well as a comedy, even though it's talking about how simplistic films in 1941, when everybody was talking about World War II, Preston Sturges is saying, you know what? We know that the war is happening. We see it every day. And sometimes you just want to laugh and you want to forget that that's going on. And he tells it in a very earnest and well-meaning story that's very funny at the same time. Preston Sturges was born into wealth and wanted to make these movies that talked about wealthy people, or more specifically, people who were just struggling to get by, who wanted to be wealthy, and having to realize all of the issues that come about with that. And Miracle in Morgan's Creek is one of the few that has characters who are middle class. Most of his movies are about upper, at least poor people who want to be upper class or upper class people. And for me, Miracle in Morgan's Creek is probably his most subversive. Everything else, I know a lot of people love Lady Eve or Christmas in July, which have really good messages. But for me, I think this is the one that is the most sharply written in terms of dialogue, in terms of how characters interact. It's not flawless, but it's so, so snarky. And it's so slyly black humor almost. For 1944, which I find just to be amazing that he was able to get away with all of that. Let's bring up the obvious, the plot. And how did Preston Sturges get away with making this movie? You have Betty Hutton's character, Trudy, Trudy Cockenlocker. She lives with her sister, Emmy, played by Diana Lynn. And we're going to talk favorite characters in a bit, but I want to say Diana Lynn is MVP of this movie.
She totally is.
She is so great. And they live with their father, who is the constable, who commonly has one of two modes, which is either berating women or wanting to beat women. She goes to this farewell dance for the troops, has this great time, wakes up the next morning, and can't remember anything, but knows that she was hanging out with a guy whose last name might be Ratsky Watsky, and she's ended up married, and she's definitely pregnant. Watching this in 2017 with new eyes in terms of how we look at one night stands, you start to question whether this movie is about an inch away from being like Ida Lupino's Outrage, which, if anybody's seen that movie, is about rape.
It totally is, especially with the views that we have now and how we're getting to a more, I hate using the word woke because it's gonna be
something. I use the term enlightened because I refuse to use that.
Okay, yes, enlightened. We are getting more. As the days go on, it is becoming, we're heading into our adolescence of social enlightenment. It's a very tough time, but we're also making strides. And when you watch this film, and you know what we talk about on a day-to-day basis, even in film Twitter, you realize that this film is very troubling because it makes you make the leap about what happened. And based off of what you're thinking about, it could be considered either she got drunk, she had a good time, or she got drunk, she blacked out, and she didn't know, and that is extremely troubling, or she doesn't want to admit. And all of these different things are in our heads, and it becomes a troubling aspect that you have to take a step back and realize this is 1944. It was a quote-unquote comedy concept that won't work now. It just absolutely will not. You could not get this film made today.
And after discussing the outdated look at disability and something like An Affair to Remember, the movie does not play it as a question of what has happened. It's definitely based on how Betty Hutton's character plays it, that she has definitely gotten drunk and made some bad decisions, but she owns them. She's trying to fix them by legitimizing them, by authenticating them, by making her marriage valid and giving her child a father. Preston Sturges writes a very fine line, because if there was that hesitation of, well, why is she doing this thing to legitimize something, the movie doesn't give you enough to say there's a reason this guy is hiding out. Has he committed a crime? Well, no, he's going off to war. And you see that these guys at the party, you know, they're saying, well, we should all get married because they're probably going to die. There's this air of wanting to be in love and escape something. Preston Sturges is a big fan of escape in his movies. This isn't like watching, and it's a bad example, but it's not like watching Gone with the Wind and thinking, in 1939, people knew this was racist and we just ignored it. In 1944, I'm genuinely sure that most people did not think, this young woman is a Law & Order SVU episode waiting to happen.
No, it's not.
Just now, we've become more involved with consent and all of that. It's one of those movies that, yeah, I doubt this would ever get remade without having to have lines in there about just talking about a modern movie, Knocked Up, and the questions of consent in that situation and how the movie mitigates that. And here, it mitigates that by really not saying, although you get quite a few scenes of her going from A to B with these guys in this jalopy and they're swigging booze and they're, I mean, we get pretty much everything but going into the bedroom. And the fact that she says to her father at a certain point, I'm going to have a baby. We're not hiding the fact that sex took place, which I think is the most shocking element.
And that's also what I like, what helps to get over that hump is the fact that everybody goes to the solution. They don't revel in what she did. Even her father, when Constable Cockenlocker, I'm going to laugh every single time I say that.
We're okay with that. I think that's the intent.
Even back then, it was definitely the intent. As soon as he hears it, he does raise his hand, but then he automatically switches to that whole solution thing. The thing that everybody is trying to do, which is find a solution for this situation. And I think that that does help ease everything, because it's not like she's sitting there saying that this never should have happened. She's like, it happened. I don't know if it's reasonable, but she's trying to come up with solutions, even though they are, of course, and this is the crux of the film, very, very stupid and zany.
There were obviously problems with the censors over the subject matter. They said the Hayes office sent Paramount a 7-page letter about what they thought was wrong with this movie, which included remarks by Emmy, who is supposed to be 14 years old in this movie, that she is a very self-aware young woman. They also didn't like the concept of the film portraying Trudy as a drunk, and they didn't want anything involving her pregnancy. The last name Cockenlocker was totally fine with them. The rest of it was difficult. They wanted the filmmakers to, quote, be extremely careful in handling a subject of this kind because of the delicate nature of the high point of the story. And they didn't want them to make any comparisons between Trudy's situation and the Virgin Mary, because I guess people thought that that was going to happen. I don't understand that, but the War Department also didn't want the departing soldiers to be depicted as just guys that were going out and having sex with young women and then going off to war. Sturges always said that his intention with this was to, quote, show what happens to young girls who disregard their parents' advice and confuse patriotism with promiscuity. And I don't know, that's a double-edged quote for me. And I almost wonder if Sturges is saying it sarcastically, because I would say that watching this movie, even though Trudy does some bad things, her dad is also in the wrong. His whole character is presented as a buffoon who is constantly out of touch. He tries to, quote unquote, do the right thing by annulling her marriage and ends up painting her as a wanton woman. Patriotism with promiscuity, the baby boom comes up in the end. I mean, literally, Trudy at the end of this movie is a one-woman baby boom. I don't know. I take that as maybe a joke on his part.
I think that it is. Having read a couple of biographies about Sturges and specifically his early life and his formative years, and just knowing him as a persona, and also just looking at his other films and seeing how, for the time, Preston Sturges is very progressive when it comes to women and how he views them at the time. I'm not saying now, because there are definitely some troubling things in his films. You could say that he was a feminist in the way that he didn't relegate women to those specific roles. And I'm not even talking about like wife, nanny, things like that, but the archetype that they're confined to. You watch a movie like Sullivan's Travels and you see Veronica Lake. She is a woman of her own direction. When we meet her in that film, she's not chasing a man. She's not after a man. She's just living her life. And I don't think that his point of view, because of the fact he was raised by a woman who literally left his father and went on the road to become a singer in Paris, that kind of stuff kind of informs his life. And I think that him saying it is almost the sarcastic lip service of what this film is, which is, this is his propaganda film. I still cannot believe that this is his war propaganda film. I sit here and I wonder, and that's part of the reasons why I chose it.
We should mention, I mean, this was filmed in 42 and held back until 1943. By that point, Preston Sturges was already making other movies. He'd sold some scripts. But Preston Sturges was a huge success because of other movies that he had made. And Preston Sturges, I mean, he worked for Isadora Duncan, which I find to be fantastic. It's great that a lot of his females are usually crafty, and the men are these gullible, idealistic, naive figures. You can look at Miracle of Morgan's Creek, and a lot of what he's saying is how society paints women as whores, not the women themselves. So yes. Trudy has to get married, not because she really wants to, even though she says she loves Eddie Bracken's Norval, but it's really to legitimize herself. You look at something like The Palm Beach Story. Claudette Colbert's whole plot point is that she wants to finance her husband's business invention, and a man gives her the money. Her husband thinks that she did it by doing something untoward. Yes. And wants a divorce. Even something like I Married a Witch, which he didn't direct. He produced, he wrote the script, and it feels like a Preston Sturges movie in all but name. Veronica Lake's character is this woman scorned. She gets one up on this guy who wants to be a politician and pretty much ruins his career by putting him in the middle of a sex scandal. I love what he does with female characters, even though they're usually blonde and ditzy, or at least are presented as simplistic. They're not. They're very hyper aware of their position and their station in society. I think that's a good segue to talk about Betty Hutton and the women in this film, because Betty Hutton is a performer that I don't know too much about outside of her personal life. And much like a lot of Preston Sturges' characters, or the women that he worked with, much like Veronica Lake, Betty Hutton had a very hard life, ended up dying estranged from her children, and was always perceived as this difficult woman figure. This is one of the few movies that I can recall that doesn't rely on her facial contortions and mugging. She's very fun in this movie, and even though she's not a glamazon, you know, she's not Veronica Lake, she's not Claudette Colbert, she's perceived as this very confident, desirable woman. I mean, she's got soldiers lining up to dance with her.
What I love about Preston Sturges is he allows people to be exactly what they are. She's so many different things, just like Norval is so many different things. But they're on equal footing. If not, she is a little bit higher than him. And what I know her from is Annie Get Your Gun. I think that's the only thing that I really know her from. I mean, I don't remember The Greatest Show on Earth. I know that I've seen it, but I just have a hard time remembering that film. And I know that that's one of her other really big roles, but I do remember Annie Get Your Gun. The difference between Annie Get Your Gun and this film is night and day. The kind of role that it is. It's interesting to see how the studio system wanted to wrangle her. They wanted her in a certain kind of context, which didn't necessarily fit the best version of Betty Hutton.
What's interesting is that this was a movie that does not rely on Betty Hutton doing what she was famous for, which was singing. There's a scene where she is lip-syncing to some music, but she has no musical number. And after this, she would become, oddly enough, like a side player, or she played herself in a lot of wartime movies. like in those Hollywood canteen all-star vehicles, or strictly musical numbers. She didn't really get a lot of opportunities to play just a character. I'm sure frustrating to her persona, and makes this movie even more unique. And this movie really is, even though it has male characters in it, which is one of the things that I'm always surprised that the movies after this were predominantly male-based, but this is a movie that I think is anchored by women, because you have Trudy and her sister Emmy, who are the ones scheming to try to get all this stuff accomplished. I love Diana Lynn in this movie. She's hilarious as Emmy. She's supposed to be 14. She acts like she's about 25.
2 years earlier, she played, I wonder if Preston Sturges saw Major Minor, and we're talking about Billy Wilder. That one is another one that I'm always like, how did they get away with it again?
I did a recent episode playing up my love of the Major and the Minor, and I miss the days when we made classic films about grown women playing children and getting away with it. And in The Major and the Minor, Diana Lynn plays another wise beyond her years woman child, essentially, or child yes. woman. She's so great because her and William Demarest as her father are the comedic couple. Even though they're father and daughter, they're meant to be the foil, the opposite of Norville and Trudy. And it's sad to me that Diana Lynn died relatively young. She retired from acting in the 70s to actually run a travel agency, which I find to be incredibly weird. I would not have expected that. She also grew up wealthy. So there's that. Her and Preston Sturges, I think, have a lot in common. She's always over the shoulder of William Demarest's character, kind of playing like the devil on his shoulder to remind him how stupid he is. Everything is, I'm going to tell you that you're wrong, and you're going to listen to it, too. She jumps on characters' backs when they get into a fight. I mean, she throws herself into the fray. She's supportive of her sister. My favorite line in the movie is about her, where William Demarest says something, all they're going to find is a hair ribbon and an axe, the mystery of Morgan's Creek. She's the character, the little sister character that you would want to kill, but she's also the smartest one in the entire movie.
She totally is. Normally, in modern film, this is a trope. This is just like a cliche. Yeah. This is a total cliche, but handled by Preston Sturges and performed by Diana Lynn, it's this really fresh take on things that you've seen time and time again in rom-coms. That wisecracking sidekick sister, comic relief, whatever you want to call it. You know, Melissa McCarthy did it in Bridesmaids. Carrie Fisher did it in Harry and Sally. I mean, maybe I've not seen enough classic cinema to know. She feels like archetype. She feels like, or actually the prototype of this. I don't remember before seeing this character specifically as vividly realized as it is here, where all the great lines in a scene that she's in goes to her.
There's been other little sister characters and stuff, like the Ginger Rogers movie Tom, Dick, and Harry has a little sister character that's similar to this, and Diana Lynn, I think, really personifies it, because she's the one organizing this fake marriage, and she's trying to hide the fact that her sister is pregnant. It's really that becomes this grand satire, almost, of how a young girl gets pregnant in a small town and suddenly it's everybody's business. Who is the father and who is she married to? And I think that goes really well into the next thing that I wanted to bring up, which is she's pregnant in this movie. The movie culminates with the birth of the baby, or more specifically, six babies. The movie really ends as a nightmare for Norville. Yeah, the movie ends with Trudy having just birthed six children in 1944, and she still looks like Betty Hutton. She's got her hair in, like, little piggytails, and she looks like she's beautiful. You know, she's got a full face of makeup on. And Norville is this proud papa that has an instant family and has to deal with the fact that he has six children and a wife and no job. And I really think that Sturges, not necessarily screw you, to the fact that we were sending young boys off to war and leaving these families behind to effectively raise themselves, but also saying to men, even though he's talking about, oh, we don't want to confuse promiscuity with patriotism, it's also saying to men, if you're gonna have sex, this is the price you pay.
it really is an interesting moment because you can almost feel the Hays Code notes when it ends, because it ends with him, isn't he trying to jump out the window, or he like runs out? But then there's a postscript about how Norval came to his senses and he became a good father that loved all of these six boys. Preston Sturges doesn't play like that. It would have been, I almost feel like his probably maybe his first cut was Norval trying to run away. And then that just ends, because it ends on a laugh. It's funny. It's disturbing. It's dark, but it's funny. And it seems like the kind of Preston Sturges moment that you would end a movie on, not this postscript where he came to his senses. Don't worry, guys. There's nothing to worry about here. He's going to be the father to these children that the man who actually impregnated her could never be, because he's going to die.
Preston Sturges, really, for a man I think that was married three times, really has a funny series of Deus Machinas, God's machines, in his movies. Like Sullivan's Travels ends with effectively everything is wrapped up by everyone believing that Joel McRae's character has been viciously murdered. He gets what he wants, everything he wants, and he, mind you, he had only had to spend a couple days cracking rocks in jail. The end of I Married a Witch, it's written by him, ends with the knowledge that Frederick March's character is surrounded by two witches. His daughter is a witch. So Preston Sturges really enjoys playing with these happily ever after question mark. That really marriage and all of that it entails comes with a price. And I don't think it's any more terrifying than Miracle of Morgan's Creek. And it's also not nearly as pointed in other movies, because again, this came out in, filmed in 42, but came out in 44. The war still had about another year before it even ended. And he's saying, here's this guy who's got six boys that are all going to go off to war if we keep this up. Are they just born to die? Or it's a very cynical ending, I think you could read it. I don't think it reads as positive, necessarily.
It does not. Six kids. That's what I keep on going back to, is that it's six kids, and he's a dope. The thing that I love about the movie is I don't like Norval, but I like the idea and the way that Norval is presented. Because Norval is essentially, if you think about it, what makes this so unique is that essentially this is a film that in 1942, the roles should have been flipped. Eddie Bracken plays it should be the same way that Betty Hutton would have normally played it in any that was filmed in 1942. But instead, you have the guy who's constantly pining for this one girl. Another trope that will be played through up until now. You have whole movies that are based off of this premise. 500 Days of Summer, What If, any other number of movies about the quote-unquote beta male secretly pining for somebody. But it's interesting here because he's emasculated. Everything about Norval is emasculation. And I find that fascinating, because rather than fight against it, Eddie Bracken really leans into it, and leans into it in a way that you're talking to a guy that actually grew up with a stutter. And that still bothers me. Eddie Bracken's like weird affectation with his Porky Pig stutter still bothers me to this day. No matter how many times I watch it, the first 20 or 30 minutes of this movie, it bothers me, because he's playing it for comic effect. But if I take a step back, I can realize and appreciate he is really leaning into this role. He doesn't play it with a wink and a nudge. He is playing Norval as Norval would be. He reminds me a lot of the analogous, to me at least, is Tim Blake Nelson in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The Coens are Sturges disciples.
The end of this movie, in 1940, the first set of quintuplets had been born. Trudy having six babies would have been a huge deal, and I find it intriguing that the movie ends with Hitler and Mussolini freaking out, because Nazi Germany and fascist Italy were telling women to have more babies. In this movie, having more babies is probably the worst thing that you could have done in the war years. So I find that, again, another sly little bit of subversion in terms of how we perpetuate motherhood in our country versus internationally, especially in the 1940s. But Eddie Bracken, I find him to be probably the part I dislike the most about this movie. I find Eddie Bracken to be very annoying in this film, mostly because of the stutter. It starts out, I can handle it, and it feels like as the movie progresses, it becomes more prominent in every line. It takes him like 20 minutes to say one thing. And this movie is reliant on rapid-fire dialogue.
Yes.
And having to wait for him to finish a sentence is, especially when Betty Hutton's character is able to sound rushed and frantic while still getting words out, it really feels like a disconnect, especially since I never feel like these two characters would be together. As you mentioned, Norville always feels like the character that pines and would really have no shot. It's even more unbelievable in the other movie that he made for Press and Sturges in 1944, Hail the Conquering Hero, which is a really good movie and again plays with the war movie, and we'll talk a little bit more about war movies in a second, but Hail the Conquering Hero is about Eddie Bracken's character who is discharged from the army because of a sickly constitution, but lies and says that he was honorably discharged and was a hero. And he gets Ella Raines in that movie, who is, no offense to Betty Hutton, Ella Raines is drop-dead gorgeous. So I never really buy Eddie Bracken leading man. He's always more of a side character, or he's always the toy store owner in Home Alone 2. But here, I mean, he's fine. I do think a lot of his comedy is the predominantly physical. And when you have William Demarest's character, who is also a physical comedian, it becomes overbearing.
I can see that, yeah. I'm not a big Eddie Bracken fan, so his work here is par for the course for me. It's the stutter, it's the inability. Some of the stuff is really out of place. The physical comedy is, I guess, somewhat okay, but it feels like at a certain point when they're in the prison, they're trying to push him out. Her father is trying to push him out. And the kind of little business that they're doing, they're going back and forth with, it seems a little out of place in this film. Especially the rapid
fire. It's a little Abbott and Costello, almost. Like a comedy team type of deal.
Yeah.
I do think that even though this movie is only 98 minutes, it does have a little bloat. And that's mainly because of Eddie Bracken's character. I prefer it a lot more when it's about Trudy and her story. I did want to bring up briefly the war imagery, because we've talked about it briefly. Preston Sturges was a wartime director.
Yes.
And a lot of people would be very surprised to know that he only directed 14 films in his entire career. Wrote 45 films, but only directed 14 from 1940 to 1955. Most of his movies, about 98% of them, were war or immediately after World War II. He always likes to play with the politics that come from war creation. So, Hail the Conquering Hero, again, is about this guy that fabricates this war story so that he can come home with medals and get this hero's welcome, and what does that really mean? I like to say that he's trying to be Frank Capra if Frank Capra was a cynic. And even something like The Great McGinty, which is connected to this movie in a very odd way, Brian Donlevy and Akeem Tamaroff, who will play their same characters in this movie as they do in The Great McGinty, which if you hadn't seen The Great McGinty like I had until I saw it a couple years later, you have no concept of who they are, which is why I love talking about how audiences in 1940, because we didn't have home video, would they have remembered 4 years later that these characters were the same characters from that film? I'm assuming not.
No, I don't think so, just because it's never said that he is Governor McGinty, even though he is essentially playing the same role. I love that moment, because when I saw this actually in order. It would have been about 2000 after I'd, of course, like everybody, Coen Brothers, their thing. It forced me down this rabbit hole of Preston Sturges very quickly, but it was a pleasant surprise because that character and like that character in that movie and Where It Ends and Miracle in Morgan Creek. And to see this person just come back, it's like, oh, whoa, okay.
I guess it's not that odd considering that The Great McGinty is a somewhat similar story. You have Depression era bum played by Brian Donlevy, who is recruited to be this political figure to help with voter fraud. Again, shades of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he decides that he's going to be this reform mayor, but he has to get married, so he gets involved in this in-name-only marriage and ends up turning from this crooked person to a person who has this moment of clarity. And there's shades of similarity to Miracle of Morgan's Creek, but most of his war movies feel very dark and cynical talking about the machine that makes wars run, and how the people who are left behind have to deal with the unknown, and at the same time, how easy it is to get involved in politics and what that means when you have all that power.
I love the fact that he doesn't approach... You mentioned something that I've always felt, which is you mentioned Capra. I always felt like he was the guy that looked at Capra and laughed at Capra's optimism and said, no. Let me tell you a story. Miracle on Morgan's Creek is kind of a Capra story, but done with Preston Sturges's wit and sarcasm and cynicism, which I much prefer. I mean, I like Capra. I think that he doesn't get enough credit for the darkness that he brings, but ultimately he is a bright shining light, and he uses that darkness in his films to make that light shine even brighter, whereas Preston Sturges could care less about the light. He's like, that doesn't interest me.
What's funny is that his movies are not necessarily about the war and the pining and the constant death, although that's always around. And it's about the small town life and how people cope with their current situations, which are created by this government machine that has created this war that in turn has created these dire circumstances. So he's doing something grander, that Capra is coming up with solutions. We employ this, then we could get this. But people don't do those things, so that's where we're at. Sturges pretty much says, we have no solutions. If we have solutions, we wouldn't know what to do with them, or we wouldn't care. Those are his options, which is refreshing and also very depressing.
But it makes for electrifying filmmaking. The first time I watched The Great McGinty, I was shocked. I looked around, I was like, how did this dude get away with this? Literally in 1940, when you're at the height of the propaganda machine going and saying you have to create movies that uplift the soul. And this movie is as cynical a political movie as I've ever seen. It's one of the first movies I put on in 2017. That tells you how cynical it is, people. What I love about when you get a director during this era that can navigate it is that it's not cynical for cynical's sake. It makes a point. Because Preston Sturges had to navigate these tricky waters of the Hays Code, production code, overbearing producers, executives, he still managed to get everything that he wanted to say, it seems, through the system. But it may have not been as clear and concise, but I don't think that clear and concise necessarily cuts it sometimes.
We should mention this was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay the same year that he was nominated for the same award for Hail the Conquering Hero.
Yes.
So it kind of canceled each other out. So he didn't win, which I think it's insane to realize that Preston Sturges, he did win an Oscar.
Best Original Screenplay, the first one, which is ironic to say the least.
And it's shocking to me that he was only nominated three times, won once.
Yep.
And it was not for Miracle of Morgan's Creek or Sullivan's Travels, which I think is also well written. Hail the Conquering Hero, it's been a long time since I've seen it. We did want to bring up the Coens, because the Coen brothers have been very vocal about how inspired they are by Preston Sturges. I remember when Intolerable Cruelty came out, George Clooney was going on about how Oh Brother Where Art Thou was inspired by Sullivan's Travels and that he had watched a lot of Preston Sturges movies. The Coens really enjoy the same cynicism that Preston Sturges does. I mean, you watch nearly any Coen movie with maybe, well, I was going to say even Intolerable Cruelty is cynical at the end of it. They're all very bleak, even though there are moments of high points. They're all very grim.
They understand, like Preston Sturges, it's not cynicism for cynicism's sake. They have this outlook on life. It's very similar to Preston Sturges. The month or two that I went through his filmography, the Coen brothers' movies started to make a lot more sense to me. The way they came from, where their points of view were, their attitude towards things made a lot more sense. I mean, we have a new one coming out fairly soon, Suburbicon. It feels like an extension of Preston Sturges.
Preston Sturges movies in general always have this method to the madness, even though they're supposed to play as very hokey and unscripted. And Preston Sturges was a perfectionist of a director. He scripted every little thing down to the minute, was known for very long takes of having actors perform these pages of dialogue. Everything feels like it's improvised. You look at something like, everybody's going to roll their eyes and expect me to come up with this, but it makes sense. If you look at Inside Llewyn Davis, that whole movie, the way that the dialectic of choices builds on each other. If he didn't do one thing, then that wouldn't have happened, and that wouldn't... I mean, you can find a common thread.
Oh, yeah.
Watching Miracle of Morgan's Creek is very similar. You know, there is a common thread. Had Trudy not done this, that wouldn't have happened. And then if that didn't happen, this wouldn't have happened. So they are really great at creating this web, this ladder that just leads to chaos.
They both do. I love both the Coens and Preston Sturges' adherence to formality, but formality in their own rules. There are rules to a Coen Brothers film as much as there are rules to Preston Sturges films. It's just when you first watch them, they may not necessarily present themselves to you. That's why I always watch a Coen Brothers film twice, just to make sure I was in the right frame of mind to see it, because I might outright reject it. You bring up Inside Llewyn Davis. I talk about it as a movie that's both a character piece and a very rigid formed, plotted film. Like what you were talking about with building upon action, that's exactly what they do. And that takes skill and being very rigid to plot, to making sure that every line of dialogue is perfect. And that's exactly the way that Preston Sturges films work. Plot is all based out of either emotionality or dialogue, but it's not plot expositional dialogue. It's just literally dialogue moving forward. The way The Miracle of Morgan's Creek starts off, it's all in the dialogue between Trudy and Norville about how she's going to this dance and she needs Norville's car, and she's essentially conning him. This action, if this doesn't happen, or if he stands his ground and says no, I don't think we have the movie. The plot doesn't move forward.
You see that in all of Trudy's decision making. There's a great moment where she comes back from this night of whatever, and Norville's trying to explain to her that it's 8 o'clock, and she says, well, why is it so late? You know, my dad's gonna be awake. And he's like, something, you're driving my car. This is your car? You know, it's almost like watching bringing a baby in terms of characters knowing these things but are just so blithely in their own selfishness that they're not noticing it, which again is another Coen's trope. They really love selfish characters, but yet the selfishness is endearing. Betty Hutton wasn't such a great actress. You would hate this character. Norval would be a doormat, she'd be a big pain, and nothing would ever get accomplished. It's the fact that her selfishness is so blithe and it's so intoxicating, that her confidence and her fun, she's got that big smile, you get entranced by it, and it ends up getting her in trouble, but it also ends up getting her out of trouble.
And that is not just her being a selfish character, is not just limited to this particular Preston Sturges film. He loved characters that were greedy, that were selfish, that were self-centered, that were arrogant. He loved the hubris of human beings, and he loved, like the Coens, to put those people into situations just to see how they interacted and how they reacted and what happened. This is where Preston Sturges is a genius, is truly interact and act out in a way that is becoming of that particular character. I believe every single thing that happens in The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, even though it may be heightened, it may be ridiculous, I believe everything that they do, everything that they do to try to justify or to legitimize this marriage and pregnancy.
I'm current on Preston Sturges up until Hail the Conquering Hero. The great moment on is the last of his 44 films into his last couple of films I still have to see. Great moment, Harold Diddlebach, Unfaithfully Yours, Beautiful Blonde of Bashful Bend. Thankfully, he's not a director with like 1,000 credits, so it's not going to take me. I have no excuse to not see the rest of them. It's good to talk about him because I think he's influenced comedy so much, And yet, because he had so few credits, he wasn't like Capra. He wasn't like Leo McCarey. Even though Leo McCarey made, I think, around a little bit more, but less than the average filmmaker today, Preston Sturges, I think, gets swept under the rug. He died in 59. He never really got to deal with the later appreciation, the repertory scene in the 80s and the 90s, bringing back his movies. He really missed out on a lot of that. If you haven't seen a Preston Sturges movie, you really should. We're going to wrap this up. I say Miracle of Morgan's Creek is Preston Sturges at his blackest comedy. But that's really something you can say about all of his movies. I would also say watch Sullivan's Travels, The Lady Eve, Palm Beach Story. We talk about classic era as being this time and place where sex was implied, but movies weren't necessarily sexy. Preston Sturges really undoes all that, because not only is Miracle of Morgan's Creek a movie that literally has sex on the brain, again, character's name is Cockenwalker. I would also say you look at something like The Palm Beach Story, which has easily one of the sauciest scenes involving Claudette Colbert sitting on Joel McRae's lap, that you get the swoon just thinking about it. Adam, what are your final thoughts about Miracle of Morgan's Creek and Preston Sturges?
Watch everything that he's done, including his produced work, especially his produced work. It will only lead you to appreciate him as a director more. If you like The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, I would definitely suggest you guys do exactly what Kristen was saying, which is do a deep dive. I don't think that you will be disappointed, especially if I would go even further and say, couple them with Coen Brothers films to make it even that more palpable. And you will find yourself falling in love with a man who had the most cynical point of view of human beings, but also possibly one of the most humanistic point of views of human beings. If I make another suggestion after this one, go to Unfaithfully Yours, which is my personal favorite of his, with a very, very, very charming and witty Rex Harrison, when Rex Harrison was young, where he hires somebody to kill his wife, but you still manage to like him through the entire film. I would definitely say he's a worthy addition to any film geek or film fans' list of films that they need to watch if they have not watched. Miracle of Morgan's Creek is just a fascinating, even if you don't like it, it's still a fascinating portrait of what could be gotten away with during this time.
Listeners, feel free to send me your thoughts about Preston Sturges or The Miracle of Morgan's Creek. You can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read your thoughts on a future episode. Once again, I'd like to thank the amazing Adam Kautzer. I just realized we jumped right into our discussion, and I never gave you a chance to tell us about yourself and promote. So as we say goodbye, Adam, why don't you tell us about your projects and where fans can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. I write for a film site based out of the East Coast called Film Dispenser. Filmdispenser.com is the website address. Most of my work is under the podcast banner of the B-Movie Podcast. I write and podcast about underseen genre, classic, or exploitation films. Anything that is little seen or little discussed, I talk about it on my podcast. Kristen has been on the podcast where we talked about some very different modern films, Sugar and Spice and Bling Ring. You can always get that on an iTunes feed. It's just the B-Movie Podcast. That's what it's called. Right now, currently, we're in the middle of doing a neo-noir series where we're looking at modern films, the noir trappings. I'm just about to post an episode on Rian Johnson's Brick. So you can always still go ahead and check that out. I'm on Twitter and Instagram. The handle is BMoviePod. The letter B, the word movie, the word pod. No lines, no dashes, no nothing.
We do have some listener feedback this week. This comes courtesy of Joyce R. and is in regards to my episode on the top three Maureen O'Hara movies. Joyce says that Quiet Man, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and The Parent Trap are her favorite O'Hara films. She says, quote, I think her co-star was not a great choice. I'm assuming here she means in The Parent Trap. She says, quote, she and John Wayne played off each other so much better. Thanks, Joyce, for your thoughts. I still have to watch She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, but I've heard very good things about it, and I'm eager to see more Maureen O'Hara movies. She's just amazing. That closes out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or now on Player FM. course, you can always listen via iTunes. If you are listening on iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review to help the show out. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or you can visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, and I'm trying to get back on schedule, so hopefully this will be out next week, guest Robert Hamer is going to join me to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Belle du Jour. Till next time!